From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump's National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster is responding today to questions about that bombshell story that broke last night, that President Trump shared highly classified information with Russia's foreign minister and ambassador last week. Here's McMaster speaking today.
I stand by my statement that I made yesterday. What I'm saying is really the premise of that article is false, that in any way the president had a conversation that was inappropriate or that resulted in any kind of lapse in national security. And so I think the real issue, and I think what I'd like to see really debated more, is that our national security has been put at risk by those violating confidentiality and those releasing information to the press that could be used connected with other information available to make American citizens and others more vulnerable.
Last night, after the story broke, McMaster downplayed the substance of what President Trump revealed.
At no time, were intelligence sources or methods discussed. And the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known.
Well, today, President Trump defended his right to share the information. In a pair of tweets, he said he has an absolute right as president to do so. Joining us now is retired Admiral James Stavridis, now dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And Admiral Stavridis, what's your reaction to this story, to McMaster's statement and President Trump's tweets today?
I've got to think that Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, who I must stipulate is a close friend of mine, must watch that tweet with a sinking heart. It makes him look as though he came out in front of those cameras and tried to set up a situation in which the president did not leak any classified information, but then you have a president the next morning almost gleefully indicating that he had, in fact, given classified information to the Russians. Got to be a terrible feeling for National Security Advisor Lieutenant General McMaster this morning.
Well, one of the questions that's being asked today is why, if McMaster was in the room when President Trump did this, didn't he stop him?
Well, I have been in those meetings in the Oval Office, and here's a news flash. Occasionally, a president will launch off down a path that perhaps you don't think is the ideal way for the president to be articulating something. I have never been in a situation where one of my seniors began to reveal classified information. I don't know how I would react, but the idea that General McMaster would leap up and effectively clamp his hand around the president's mouth is, I think, far-fetched. So what I suspect happened is immediately afterward, the National Security Council staff went into damage control mode, looped back to all the intelligence agencies to inform them that the president had revealed this, and that's what has led us to the story in the Washington Post.
And as we know, there's nothing illegal about this because the president does have the right to do this. But what are the consequences, do you think?
I think there are three, and they're all bad. One is the tactical danger that we put the source of that intelligence in. Intelligence is like a mosaic, Jeremy, and your opponents have kind of little chips here and there, but they may not have the full picture. Whatever was revealed possibly fills in the picture and puts somebody at risk. Secondly, and worse, our allies will hesitate to share intelligence with us. Picture how we would feel if Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany had revealed sensitive U.S. intelligence to the Russians in a meeting. We'd be shocked. We would immediately cut off intelligence sharing. And thirdly, and finally, who are the winners here? The winners are the Russians. Not only do they get the intelligence, but they continue to sow confusion and blow up Washington so we can't deal with the urgent and pressing needs of the day.
You mentioned allies sharing information with us. What about the U.S. intelligence community itself? Are they going to be hesitant to share information with the White House?
They will be hesitant, but they are professionals. They know their job. They'll follow the law. They will push through their leadership to avoid something like this happening again. But there will be hesitation. However, they will follow their orders and they will provide intelligence to the president.
One more question. President Trump leaves this week on his first foreign trip. He's going to be in Saudi Arabia. He'll go to the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis. In Brussels, he'll be meeting with NATO leaders before moving on to the G7 economic meeting in Sicily. What do you think he needs to accomplish on this trip?
First and foremost, he needs to demonstrate that he is a sober, serious leader who is not prone to slips of ego like we saw in the White House with the Russians. Secondly, he needs to lay out a coherent vision of where he sees the U.S. allied relationships. The Saudis, the Israelis, our NATO allies, above all, they want to hear that we are going to do things in the world with our coalition partners. They're afraid of this idea of America first overtaking the idea of working with coalition and allies. And thirdly, he needs to make personal connections. That's something I think he's good at, actually. And I think that'll be a significant part of it, is his interpersonal relations with the leaders. Those are the three things he'll focus on.
That's retired Admiral James Stavridis, now Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, turning now to a terrifying editorial headline in the Washington Post that caught our eye this week. Too many children are killed for insurance money. It went on to detail cases in which policies were taken out on a 15-month-old by his father, a 10-year-old by adoptive parents, who then killed the children for huge insurance payouts. How can this be? How can a life insurance policy become, as the Post put it, a murder weapon? The editorial grew out of a letter Dennis Jay wrote to the paper about the problem. He's executive director of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. He joins us. And Dennis, people have heard of adults taking out policies on spouses and then murdering them. It is chilling. But children, tell us about the 15-month-old killed by his father.
This was in Virginia, and the 15-month-old, his name was Prince Rams. And he basically lived with his mother, but the father would come and pick him up and take him for a day. And unbeknownst to the mother, the father took out three life insurance policies that equaled more than $500,000, and then subsequently killed young Prince. Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of the most horrific aspects of insurance fraud, and it's sad because it's preventable.
Well, you in your letter to the Post documented so many cases, which was astonishing, but because states have regulations, what's going wrong here? Why are people able to buy policies for infants when obviously nobody's going to pay on a life insurance policy for a life that should last 80 years? So what's the disconnect here?
Well, there are some states where you cannot buy a huge dollar amount of life insurance on kids. And we're trying to generate some awareness among consumers, among state legislators and insurance regulators, that there's things we all can do to help prevent this. And one of the big things is for the state to have regulations and laws that encourage insurance companies to adopt policies that just do not allow such things to happen.
For instance, New York sets maximum life insurance limits for juveniles. Washington State changed some of its regulations after, you know, two terrible stories there. A 10-year-old who'd been adopted by a couple who purchased a $650,000 policy on him, and he was then killed. A 3-year-old drowned by her stepfather. He had a $200,000 policy. You know, what did Washington do? And what else can you do? I mean, should insurers, when they sell policies, be looking at the financial situation of the people buying the policy? Should there be red flags there?
Absolutely. There has to be an insurable interest, which means if you take a life insurance policy out on a kid, if something happens to that kid, you have a financial loss. And that does happen in some cases where, you know, maybe it's a child prodigy or a child actor or a budding rock star, or, you know, the child just has inherited a lot of money or whatever. But in most cases, people should not be taking out high dollar, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $250,000 on a child, because there just isn't that loss there. So that's mm-hmm. one thing insurance companies should be taking a look at. They should also be taking a look at things like, is there a signature of both parents on the insurance application before the insurance is put into force? Is there life insurance on other people in the family? You know, in many of these cases, afterwards, we found that the fathers or mothers or legal guardians didn't even have insurance on themselves, yet they were taking it out on a kid.
Or in one case, there was a trail of other policies that had been taken out on other people who had mysteriously died. So things like this, and you know, I mentioned the financial thing. If somebody is in financial distress, that might be a red flag too, if they're trying to take a policy out on a child. Isn't one problem, though, that some policies can now be bought online?
That's increasingly a problem where you're not actually meeting the person who's applying for insurance, or it's maybe a little bit harder to verify their identity or their relationship to the person that they're insuring. Sure. But still, we have to do whatever we can do to prevent this type of crime. And we'd like to see insurance companies doing more.
Dennis Jay, Executive Director of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. You can read his letter to the editor and the Washington Post's chilling subsequent editorial at hereandnow.org. Dennis, thank you.
You're welcome.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao said this week that President Trump's infrastructure plan will be out within weeks and will include $200 billion in federal spending. That money would be used to leverage $1 trillion in private spending on infrastructure over the next decade. Joining us now is Ray LaHood, former U.S. Transportation Secretary under President Obama. He's now co-chair of the group Building America's Future. And Secretary LaHood, is leveraging private money with $200 billion in federal spending the right approach?
I do think that public-private partnerships, the 3P program, is very, very important, particularly for the big projects. Currently, today, there are 60,000 structurally deficient bridges in America. And the reason I mention that is because these are big projects. They're expensive projects. They'll take a 3P type of approach in order to fund them over a period of time. But I also think that we shouldn't give up on the idea that the Highway Trust Fund is what built America. The Highway Trust Fund is what built the interstate system. The Highway Trust Fund is funded by the gas taxes that are collected at the pump. And we've promoted the idea that Congress should debate and pass a increase in the gas tax, perhaps at about 10 cents a gallon, and index it. 3Ps will work for big projects, but in order to get to some of the other significant work that needs to be done in America on our roads, on our transit systems, with Amtrak, and certainly with other forms of transportation, it will take increasing the gas tax. It will take infrastructure bank.
Well, but you're a former Republican member of Congress. Isn't it Republicans in Congress who are so opposed to raising the gas tax because they've signed pledges in many cases not to raise any tax?
Well, that is correct. I am a former Republican member of Congress that served during a time when we passed 2 6-year transportation bills and fully funded them, and it was done in a very bipartisan way. I'm also pleased with the statement made by President Trump, a Republican, who said 2 weeks ago that he favored an increase in the gas tax. That's the kind of leadership that we need from the White House in order to rebuild the Highway Trust Fund, in order to have the money that we need to do all the things that are necessary to get to a $1 trillion program and get it funded.
When we talk about $1 trillion, and then we said also $200 billion in federal funding, it sounds like a lot of money, $1.2 trillion. But when you look at how much is out there to be done with infrastructure, is it a lot?
It's a good start. It's not perfect, but it's a very good start. And it's certainly a better start than what we've seen in the past, where Congress have passed pretty chintzy transportation bills without the funding to really move us forward. That's the reason we have 60,000 structurally deficient bridges. That's why the interstate system's falling apart. That's why 50-60-year-old transit systems need money. That's why Amtrak needs money. Because we really haven't kept up with our infrastructure.
So even if you were to deal with all of those structurally deficient bridges and all the highways that need repair, we're still dealing with an infrastructure system that was planned a long time ago. What about planning for the future, building new things that don't exist yet?
That's what we did while we were at DOT under the Obama administration. We started a high-speed rail program and invested $8 billion. Currently, California is building a train from San Francisco to L.A. that'll go 200 miles an hour. That's why we were instrumental in providing the funding, excuse me, for streetcar projects, for light rail projects, for bike share projects, for walking and biking paths. A lot of progress has been made in developing livable and sustainable communities during President Obama's administration, much of it funded through the economic stimulus, the $48 billion that was provided through the economic stimulus. But if you look around America today, every big city now has a bike share program. Many of the cities have walking and biking paths. Many of the cities have light rail or streetcars. All of that developed over the last 9 years by investing either through cities, states, or the federal government. So new things have occurred in transportation.
Do you see a day in America where there's a true high-speed rail network?
No, I really don't, because there's not a commitment on the part of the federal government to do that. When people come back from Europe and China and Asia scratching their head after riding a train, wondering why we don't have it in America, it's because we've never had the commitment from our national government to do that. President Obama put $8 billion in the economic stimulus. That's $8 billion times more than it was ever invested in rail by the national government. Most of that money went to California, and Governor Brown got the legislature there to invest money, has found private developers to invest money. Without a commitment from the national government, the reason that Europe has good trains is because the national governments in Europe invested in trains. Because China is building new rail every day, because Japan has the best rail service maybe in the world, it's because the national government made a commitment. And we have not had that kind of leadership in America.
Secretary LaHood, given everything that's going on right now in Washington and the firing of James Comey and some of the other things that are taking up a lot of the oxygen, how likely do you think it is that President Trump will be able to push forward with this $1 trillion infrastructure plan?
Well, he talks about it quite often. His Secretary of Transportation, I know, is working very, very hard on developing a plan along with people in the White House. So I know they're working on it. I also know that people like Senator Schumer from New York have a great deal of interest in the Gateway Project, which is a very expensive project to deliver people all around the New York, New Jersey region. So I think there'll not only be leadership from the White House, I think there'll be leadership from the Democrats. Senator McConnell, who's a majority leader in the Senate, a Republican, his wife is serving as DOT secretary. I think there's going to be a lot of interest. And I believe this is one of the most bipartisan opportunities for the Congress to step up and do what many states have done, which is implement a very strong infrastructure program.
That's Ray LaHood, former U.S. Transportation Secretary and now co-chair of Building America's Future. Secretary LaHood, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, in Phoenix, a two-story building serves as a sort of giant ATM for banks across the country. It's one of 28 Federal Reserve centers where regional banks make deposits and withdraws. Christina Estes of Here and Now contributor KJZZ took a tour to see where all that money goes.
At first, it feels like you're going through airport security. But past the main entrance, it starts to feel more like a prison. Beyond bulletproof glass, there's a wall covered with weapons, and getting closer to the cash involves shuffling between thick doors.
I was actually petrified because I was surrounded by so much.
That's Rick remembering his first few weeks receiving bank deposits. We're only using his first name to protect his identity because he works with a lot of money.
When you're, you know, surrounded by so much, it's daunting.
Last year, Phoenix employees processed nearly 670 million bills, or notes as the Federal Reserve calls them. Abby McLennan manages operations here.
So this is our currency receiving room.
It's where armored trucks deliver bank deposits and employees perform what they call strap and bundle counts.
So the containers that you see in the room, each container can hold approximately 450 bundles.
A container of ones can add up to 450,000, while a container of 20s can total 9 million. The next step involves a more detailed verification process. Before I can enter the glass-walled room, McLennan calls for a police escort and has me put on an orange vest.
It's just so they can visually recognize you, that you're not part of the team.
Workers like Olivia feed bills into a big machine.
It's going to go through sensors, and the sensor will detect if the currency needs to be shredded, or sometimes we have suspect notes that come out.
Suspect notes could be counterfeit, so they're sent to the Secret Service for investigation. Notes that are shredded are considered unfit. They may be worn or torn, which could make it tough to determine whether they're real. About 50 people work here, along with two non-humans, nicknamed Bonnie and Clyde.
I think Bonnie's the ringleader.
Bonnie and Clyde are automated guided vehicles, and they're the only ones allowed inside the vault. Cranes move up and down, grabbing containers for Bonnie and Clyde to carry to their coworkers. It's not just the sight that can wow you, it's also the scent, especially for workers like Rick, who are constantly surrounded by piles of cash.
It can vary from time to time. It can smell like a casino, smoke. It can smell like a gymnasium, running shoes, or track. It varies, even sometimes like dirt.
When Rick first started his job, he was in awe. That disappeared, though, after about 3 months.
Now it's a recycling operation. Bring it in, get it out.
But that sense of awe returns when you ask Rick to compare new money to notes that are labeled fit, meaning they've been around a while.
New money is crisp, it's clean, it has that sort of smell of sweet ink. It's very, very different than the fit.
You look like you have a crush on new money.
You usually know that new money isn't going to come back for quite some time.
The average lifespan for denominations under 20 is about 5 years. Our biggest bill, the 100, generally lasts the longest, 15 years. For Here and Now, I'm Christina Estes in Phoenix.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
According to many reports, Ford Motor Company is planning to cut 10% of its global workforce. Ford stock has been sliding for months, and if true, these cuts could be an effort to increase profits. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, it's good, but what about the auto industry? Automakers had been seeing rising sales, you know, after the bailouts of 2009. But this year, a number of them are seeing U.S. sales drop. Ford saw new car sales in the U.S. drop by 7% in April. What's happening?
Right. Well, this is something that the companies actually have expected themselves. They see the demand is slowing after a big boon, after their bailouts. Remember, they were coming kind of from bankruptcy and from government assistance, and that the government was helping them in sort of getting their operations back up and running. They were selling tons of cars, and now it seems like America has bought a lot of cars. The credit of subprime loans is declining, so there's a large inventory of used cars, and it's just that it's a business downturn. Now, companies like Ford have a lot of cash, and they're ready to weather this storm. And in fact, they've been warning their investors that this is going to happen. But for some reason, over the past 3 years, Ford's stock price has declined despite record sales. And this has shareholders scratching their heads and, in fact, calling for the head of the CEO of the company who went on in 2014, really when the stock started to slide.
Well, and why would that happen? I'm wondering if it has anything to do with Mexico. Bear with me here. We know earlier this year, Ford got a lot of attention after dumping plans to build a new plant in Mexico after criticism from President Trump. He took that as a triumph. But CNN reports a lot of the production slated for that new plant shifted to existing Ford plants in Mexico. So it was kind of a lateral move, and those plants are going to be expanded. So are stockholders maybe waiting to see more production shift to Mexico to cut costs?
No, I think that we're looking at a real weird time in the auto industry, actually. Okay, so yes, the supply chain is not going ideally because of President Trump's kind of nationalist ideology. And that's something that the company will have to contend with. But it has the cash to do that. What I think that shareholders are expressing here is this desire to see immense growth in their holdings. Look at Tesla. Okay, it's a company that has a share price of $317 today as we're speaking. Ford's is $10.94. Tesla sells tens of thousands of cars a year. Ford sells tens of millions of cars a year. And yet shareholders are they're basically giving Tesla, they're rewarding Tesla for that lack of achievement. And the reason is because they're looking for innovation. Ford's CEO has invested a lot of money in kind of long-term plays in autonomous driving and electric cars and things like that. But those really haven't started to make their mark in what Ford does, mm-hmm. which is the traditional car. Mm-hmm. Traditional cars are selling really, really well. But there's something about the sexy story that is Tesla, that is this new technology and this innovative CEO that has captured the imagination of people who buy stocks. And so that company is being rewarded, and Ford's CEO might have his head on the chopping block.
Or if he doesn't, think of something more sexy. Lynette Lopez, a senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Fascinating insight. Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. Today, when President Trump tweeted out that as president, he had every right to share intel with Russia, he was right. But officials say some of what he shared could endanger sources. And last night, Republican Senator Bob Corker, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said the White House is in a downward spiral. Well, what say those who voted for the president? Let's check in. Jane Maher, campaign for candidate Trump outside Boulder, Colorado. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And I just want to ask, is there any sense at all on your part that something that might have been refreshing and a poke in the eye to establishment Washington when Trump was on the campaign trail is now reckless when he's president?
No. The only thing I would say is that sometimes I feel like he tweets and uses words that aren't appropriate. But otherwise, I think his decision-making is good.
Okay, well which decisions?
Well, specifically, I think his decision to fire Comey. Mm-hmm. Rosenstein put forth a compelling case.
Well, you're talking about Rod Rosenstein, who's the deputy at the Justice Department. But Rod Rosenstein first was enraged that his memo, which he'd been asked for, was used as an excuse. And President Trump came out later and said, well, it had nothing to do with Rod Rosenstein's concerns about Comey's handling of the Clinton emails. That was his concern. And when President Trump did give an interview about it, he said, I thought about the Russia thing when I fired him. Does that give you pause that there's an investigation going on into Russia ties to the Trump campaign, and he fired the guy in charge of the investigation?
Well, I find that there's a lot of innuendos going on, even in the statements that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a story that is being propagated by the liberals and the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. I think that it's their best hope to delegitimize Trump. But there is no credible evidence to this date that there's been any improper linkage between Trump and the Russians. None.
Well, first of all, there are many Republicans who are critical. John McCain, there are others who have asked for a deeper look. But I want to get to that idea of, where information comes to you, because you've told us that you listen to a lot of mainstream media coverage of President Trump, including Here and Now. We want to thank your husband very much. But that you find it unfair, and you don't, it sounds like you don't think we're giving you true information.
I don't know that it's not true information. I think that people are listening to the kinds of reports that they want. They're often collaborating the information that they've already drawn conclusions on. And that ultimately, the facts come out to normally support the decisions that Trump makes, in spite of everything that the media will say.
Well, I'm trusting his own words when he said he was the one who wanted to fire James Comey, and that he mentioned the Russian investigation in giving his reasoning. But what about some of the other mileposts in the presidency. The health care plan passed by the House. The Congressional Budget Office said an earlier version would result in 24 million people losing health insurance. We know in the current plan, you can be charged more for pre-existing conditions. The Senate Republicans, Susan Collins and others, have said, we're tearing that up. We're not even using that.
We should all be concerned about it. But the alternative was to let Obamacare continue to spiral downward. Obviously, it's not a simple fix. It's much more complicated. Anyone who thinks that it's going to be an easy thing, I think that they're kidding themselves.
Well, that would be the president. Because remember when President Trump said, I didn't know how hard this was going to be. I mean, does that worry you that there are times when he seems surprised that this is a very, very difficult job?
So why would anybody think that before he became president, he would be perfectly prepared to know everything he needs to know before becoming president?
What's your favorite thing about President Trump?
He's frozen federal hiring. That's a fairly painless way to decrease the size of government. He's issued 2 executive orders to reduce regulations. He's proposed a budget to reduce spending. So I feel like he's taking a look piece by piece of every part of our economy and trying to say, how do I finally give it the boost it needs?
Well, and Jane, as you know, the economy's been really growing strong for over a year now. But were you not feeling it?
I would say that we benefited from it because we were able to be somewhat invested in the stock market. But I don't think that we found that middle America was really benefiting from it.
That's Jane Maher, precinct captain for Trump during the campaign in her neighborhood outside of Boulder, Colorado, and still an ardent supporter. Jane, thanks so much for speaking to us. And please, when your husband turns Here and Now on, I would love it if you, you know, give a listen and get in touch with me if you think I'm on the wrong course.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's bring in Juan Hernandez. He's in D.C. now, but he was very active in the California Trump campaign. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Robin.
So I have to point out, what you have told us, you are both Latino and gay. These are two groups that have not generally supported President Trump. How are you feeling about him at this point in office?
I'm still supporting him. I still support him 100% and what he's doing, especially with the LGBT community. I think he's following through with the promises that he did make to us. I know that there have been some appointments that maybe have not been so LGBT friendly, but they have been open to meeting with us and talking with us. So we have to remember also that people evolve, right? The politicians evolve. You know, we look at Hillary Clinton. She was completely against gay marriage. Same thing with Obama. And they've come around. And so people evolve. I get it. The RNC platform that we just had was the most horrific one for the LGBT community. It was terrible. We think it's, you know, the Cruz's camp that set that up. But we also had the faith that then nominee Trump was going to come out and not go along with what the RNC platform was. And he didn't.
Well, what about how much President Trump has been able to accomplish? He said adamantly, day one, he was going to do several things. And we see he faces an uphill battle on health care. Not much progress on building the wall with Mexico. Mexico not paying for it. The travel ban tied up in courts. Your thoughts on this president's ability to follow through?
Starting off with the wall, that was the main thing that stuck out. He had said, you know, that he's going to wait on the wall for budgetary purposes. And so I can't blame him for stopping the wall. I'm a strong supporter of the wall.
Why is that? Being, Latino, why are you for the wall?
I worked in criminal justice back in California. Mm-hmm. And I worked with people that were coming out of state incarceration who were here illegally. They commit these heinous crimes. And they release, and then all of a sudden I find out, oh, they're back in for the same exact thing. They go back and forth. I'm thinking, how are they not, like, sent back? So I see the funding that they're using. And people say, oh, no, well, they can't get public funding because they're not citizens. Well, actually, they can. When they have children here in the United States, then they start claiming money from that, and that's how they're able to get public aid. And so I see them using the system. I think we just need to take them all back over across the border, build the wall, and then we go from there.
But there's a lot of roadblocks. I mean, are you concerned that, you know, nothing's been done?
Nothing's been done. And he has put that. He specifically said that he's putting that aside for right now. And so I trust him. That's why I voted for him. You know, I trust him that he's going to follow through. He's going to follow through. Maybe not now, but in the future.
His critics might wonder, based on what you trust Donald Trump, PolitiFact, which is a completely nonpartisan fact checker, finds that something like 15% of an aggregate of his comments were true. Also, there's a tone issue that many people have with the way he seems to have a thin skin and, you know, reacts on Twitter to things. Talk a bit about the temperament and the truth.
Sometimes I wish that there would be, you know, he has a great team around him, and I wish sometimes that there would be maybe more listening to what his team says, but as you can see, I'm struggling, but I struggle because I'm not looking at all of that. Yeah, okay, he's come out and he said some things that have been proved that it's the complete opposite of what he's saying. You know, but I'm looking at the track record for us, for the LGBT. I'm looking for what he's doing with the criminal justice system. I'm looking forward to what he's going to be doing, the wall. So I'm looking at all of that instead of just the facts. I even question sometimes, why am I supporting him? Because I have a lot of liberal friends telling me these things. Okay, let me look at it. And then I still support him. I'm one of his loyal Trump supporters.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
And listeners, we're already hearing from you. For instance, yes, President Trump is against gay marriage. Your thoughts are welcome.
Investigators say it may take months to find the people behind the global cyber attack known as WannaCry, which infected hundreds of thousands of computers around the world over the weekend and held their data hostage for a ransom of Bitcoin. The attack itself has largely subsided, but questions remain about how it started and what can be done to prevent worse attacks in the future. For more on that, let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Recode reporter April Glazer joins us from San Francisco. Hi, April.
Hi.
And it does seem now, looking back a few days later, like this was not nearly as big a deal as some had feared, at least in the United States. Yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security said the list of ransomware victims in the U.S. was very small. Why was this attack ultimately so ineffective compared to what people had feared?
Well, for one, it received a ton of media attention, right? Because, you know, hospitals were forced to turn away patients and these huge multinational corporations like FedEx, you know, were debilitated. Another reason is that the perpetrators were not very sophisticated in how they built their malware, right? So the hackers baked in a kill switch into their code that shut down the encryption that the computer worm used to lock down the infected computers and make them unusable unless somebody paid up money to unlock it. And that kill switch was just simply an unregistered web address. So once a security researcher over the weekend found that domain and registered it, the malware stopped infecting new computers. Mm. And, you know, security researchers are unsure why the hackers didn't just write, you know, their code to reach out to a randomly generated URL when it attacks a computer system, rather than a single URL that was kind of hard-coded into the attack.
Now, the New York Times is reporting that security experts at Symantec and Kaspersky Lab say this attack bears similarities to others that have been linked to North Korea. There is only circumstantial evidence at this point for that claim. But what more do we know today about the possible origins of this attack?
Not much, but you know, there have been links found to North Korea, and it's because similar code was used in a Sony hack in 2014. You know, the security firm Symantec has said this. And, you know, in the Sony hack, President Obama accused North Korea of hacking into Sony to retaliate against the film comedy that the company had made called The Interview, which was kind of a fictional story about a plot to assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Well, officials at the NSA, the U.S. National Security Agency, yesterday sidestepped questions about their role in the attack. It was their information about vulnerabilities in some Windows operating systems that the hackers used to carry this out. Do you think that this incident might change anything about how the NSA stockpiles hacking tools?
Well, that's really hard to say, you know, whether this will change how the NSA finds and holds onto security flaws that it exploits in its kind of global digital surveillance operations, you know, but it might. The purpose of the NSA hacking tools isn't to shut down hospitals. You know, they're to surveil and gather intelligence or affect computers of enemies of the U.S., right? Not British emergency rooms like what happened here. But, you know, over the years, the FBI has been really vocal about how it wants companies to offer back doors to the government, right? To make it easier for the U.S. to collect people's digital communications. And this hack kind of cripples that intelligence community, the intelligence community's argument here, because companies can now say, why on earth would we make it easier for you to hack into our customers' devices and their digital lives if that backdoor might end up released and exploited and available for any hacker to build a malware attack on? They could steal people's money, all kinds of stuff.
All right. Well, we will continue to follow that story as it develops. But I want to ask you about something else today, too. And listen here to this sound from Cape Canaveral, Florida last night.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Wow. That is the sound of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket lifting off last night. SpaceX, of course, is the private space exploration company founded by Elon Musk. And last night, they launched a 6-ton communication satellite for the British company Inmarsat, built by Boeing. What is the significance of this launch for SpaceX?
Well, you know, this is the heaviest payload SpaceX has launched to space to date. This, you know, satellite was the size of about a double-decker bus, right? Just huge. Hmm. But, you know, the significance is that they're kind of reaching the pace that they've been meaning to reach. You know, at the end of April, SpaceX successfully landed one of its Falcon 9 rockets back to Earth. It has another launch scheduled at the beginning of June when it's supposed to send supplies to restock ISS. And, you know, SpaceX president said at the beginning of the year that she hoped the company would get to a point where it was launching rockets, you know, every 2 to 3 weeks. And now it seems like that's might be starting to happen.
How does SpaceX compare with its competitors at this point?
Well, you know, right now for 2017 alone, SpaceX is scheduled to fly more rockets than the two other incumbent space travel companies that are big right now, which is, you know, the Boeing Lockheed Martin kind of joint company called United Launch Alliance and the European and a European space company. And they're outpacing that. And that says a lot because SpaceX has not been around as long as those other two companies.
That's April Glazer, a reporter with Recode, talking with us about the successful SpaceX launch last night and also the hack that's been going on. April, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.